Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
On the long and winding road to South Africa, it's the big question worldwide. Are we there yet? I think I need a bathroom break. Almost, listeners, almost. And as the next World Cup takes shape, Football Weekly has all the latest. There's shock news as Leo Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo may not make the finals. But hey, Kevin Kyle might. Scotland getting their comeback underway. We catch the fallout from Argentina's Brazilian nightmare. Round up the rest of the qualifying news and ask, what was John Terry referring to when he said England players don't go down easily? Because it clearly wasn't football. Elsewhere, there's post that Chelsea transfer ban too. The charge illegally procuring young talent. Not since the days of Graham Ricks, etc, etc, and so on. All that in Football Weekly. Well, hello there, everybody. On board today, we have Apple in hand at the microphone stand, Barney Rone.
Hello.
A warm pod welcome back to Raphael Honigstein.
Hi.
Hi, Raphael. Guten Tag. Mm-hmm. And Squidward to my SpongeBob, he is Barry Glendening.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. Lots of excitements this weekend around the world of international football. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, but there's plenty of top stories out there. Among them, the fact that we've got two more teams qualified now, Ghana and Brazil. Who do they join, Barry, in South Africa?
Oh, ask me a hard one, why don't you? They join the two Koreas, Australia, Holland, and...
Japan.
Japan, yes.
And South Africa themselves.
Of course.
All right. Now, England could join that happy list this very Wednesday, if they beat Croatia, the team who in 2007 ended England's Euro hopes. Is this just a formality, Raphael Honigstein?
I think it is. Oh. The game might not be, but England getting there will be.
Right.
They've won every single game. They can afford even to slip up against Croatia and still win the group. I'm very confident. I think this is all over.
Is it? Because Slaven Bilic, the Croatian manager, said he knows England's weakness. And I'm guessing he means the fact that England players don't go down easily in the box, as John Terry was explaining, which is in danger of costing them at the World Cup, Terry explained.
Well, it was very good of him to explain that. It was an extraordinary thing for him to say at the press conference that England players don't dive because they quite clearly do, and there's plenty of evidence.
Well, Wayne Rooney clearly missed that memo when he, in fact, tumbled.
Well, I don't think Wayne Rooney dived in the match against Slovenia. I think he fell over and fouled his man and appealed for a penalty, but that's different to diving. And he got a penalty, which he shouldn't have got, but, you know, it's kind of irrelevant. It's only friendly. But, it was kind of funny coming just a day or two after John Terry's latest delusional bout.
Leaving all that aside, this Croatia game coming up on Wednesday, whether they're missing Modric and they're missing Čorluka, and it does sound a bit like empty boasting, Bilic saying, I know England's Achilles heel. But then, Bunny, you're saying that England have really not been very good for their results of late.
Well, I mean, look, when, as Rafa points out, they're quite likely to, it's quite conceivable they're going to qualify by winning every single game. And it's just a remarkable feat to manage that while all the way through your qualifying campaign looking slightly iffier every game. And by the end of the qualification campaign, we're thinking England have weaknesses at goalkeeper, right back, defensive midfield, left wing, right wing and attack. But apart from that, they're quite a good team. They probably have quite a good five-a-side team.
But that's the thing. Bilic has said, you know, that he's found England's weakness, and he won't say what it is. But I'm just astonished that there's only one weakness that he's discovered, because they do seem to have a lot, as Barony has pointed out.
It's amazing. He's very, very clearly going to have Ivica Olić running at Glenn Johnson for the whole game. And then if it does come off, he's then going to say, we knew England's weakness and we exploited it the way Hiddink did famously after that Russia result. And all the English journalists were so impressed that this tactical genius had figured it out, that Wayne Rooney was not a natural left back for that game.
It's a strange one, the Johnson, isn't it? I mean, it seems quite obvious that he shouldn't be playing in a major tournament for England, and that presumably he'll be replaced by Wes Brown. And Brown and Walcott isn't a bad right side, someone who can run fast and someone who can defend.
I find it interesting, actually, that just as an aside, Bilic has thrown his two cents into this passion for talking about diving. That's de rigueur at the moment. And he's responsible for one of the most famous of all time in the 1998 World Cup semi-final when he got Lauren Blanc sent off. So I just all these players and managers are just total hypocrites and morons.
All right, well, let me change the subject then. Kouris Mikey, with a great post. Mr. Glenn Denning remarked last Thursday that because of comical goalkeeping, no coverage of women's football is to be expected. Am I right to assume then that because of a century-old tradition of comical goalkeeping, no coverage of the male version of the English national team will be forthcoming? Could have been a bit pithier, but I like your gag. We should mention the England women's football team, who Barney, as you were excitedly pointing out, only, well, recently, are through to the final there of the European Championships in Europe.
You sound very dismissive and patronising there, James.
Au contraire.
To be fair to the women,
To be fair to the women.
Yes, to be fair to the women. I know I slagged them off in a recent pod by saying the standard of their football was pretty poor, but the England women's team, they're earning little or no money. And they're more successful than their male counterparts.
Absolutely.
So hats off to them.
As indeed we should, you know, them being women and stuff.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do they go down as easily as the men?
Ah, Barry.
I didn't mean in that way. Maybe a bit.
Now, Scotland. Oh, they beat Macedonia 2-0. Does it matter?
Well, it does matter because if they beat the Dutch, they'll be in with a shout of coming. It's a very good shout of finishing.
It's a very big if as well.
Into the playoffs. Yeah, well, Holland have nothing to play for, and the game is in hand, and stranger things have happened. At least they've given themselves a chance.
Hmm. And it was a straight. Well, I was just going to say, they rejigged their defence for this game, didn't they, and brought back David Weir. And just the thought of him playing against the Dutch attack is slightly troubling. I think it may be a slightly misleading false dawn, although they played very well.
That's the last qualifying game, after which we can start to add up the sums.
The problem is, in blatant anti-Scottish bias, FIFA have designed the rules in a way that second spot might not be enough to get into the playoffs.
There are 9 groups. There are 8 second-place teams that go into playoffs, and the second-place finishers who don't go through will be the ones with the worst record. Now, Scotland have fewer teams in their group, thanks to, I think it was M. Meister posting in and saying that in every group apart from Scotland, the second place team will have their points against the team that finished bottom in their group deducted. And then they'll see which one has the worst record.
At the moment, it's Hungary.
Exactly. Scotland are actually in 6th place in that. So if they do win this game against Holland, it's not as bleak the pitch for them as has been painted.
No. Northern Ireland are in a bigger pickle than them. Northern Ireland are 2nd from bottom in the playoff standings at the moment. The Republic of Ireland are, they're 5th.
Mm. Northern Ireland picked up a precious 1-1 draw in Poland, but the top 5 teams in Group 3 all still have chances of going through. Slovakia lead. That's who Northern Ireland are playing, of course, on Wednesday, isn't it? Carl Lafferty.
It's a real shame for Northern Ireland because they dominated large passages of the game. I saw the highlights and then got caught out 10 minutes before the end with a Lewandowski equaliser, because that win there would have put them joint top, so it's a real big blow.
Well, they have a chance to go top on Wednesday because they're going to be playing Slovakia. Slovakia do have a game in hand, but they're 2 points ahead of Northern Ireland. But Poland, Slovenia and the Czech Republic, none of them can be ruled out just yet, especially since the Czechs on Wednesday will be hosting San Marino at home. The other Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, in their group, Group 8, the top 3 all won, so no change there really. Ireland won in Cyprus, well done to them. Leaders Italy won in Georgia. Bulgaria won in Montenegro 4-1. It does look like that October clash at Croke Park is going to be the big decider vis-a-vis the group lead, but don't rule out Bulgaria, hey.
Mm-hmm. Robbie Keane has 40 international goals as
does
well.
He?
I just thought I'd mention, which is quite something.
Were you happy with their performance, Barry?
It would be unfair of me to criticise it because I didn't see it, but I'll do that anyway.
Right.
But, you know, a good win in a terrible game. I mean, it's kind of weird that all the domestic teams are doing either first or second in their group, with the exception of Wales, and none of them are particularly good teams.
Hmm.
So I don't know if that's a sort of a good reflection on how well organised they are, or a bad reflection on teams elsewhere in the continent.
Well, Italy, of course, steaming ahead there at the top of the group. They hadn't scored in their 3 previous games.
And they still didn't.
They still haven't, because both goals in a 2-0 win coming from Kaka Kaladze, a calamitous performance from the Georgian, who contributed both goals.
And he plays for AC Milan.
Crikey. Italy are in a real state. They look awful. And Marcello Lippi, who won the World Cup Was the right man at the right place, etc. Last time round, looks like he's in the wrong place right now. He was asked last week about the fact that his team have no midfield creativity at all. What about a fantasista? A journalist said. Buffon is my fantasista, he said. The creative player is the goalkeeper. And with Cannavaro responding to this 2-0 performance in Georgia, which, as you say, they didn't manage to score any goals in, with the news that, I don't know what everyone's complaining about, we've never been an entertaining side. It doesn't look like they're feeling too ambitious in the Italy camp. It's the worst, according to the papers, the worst Italy since the days of your man Giovanni Trapattoni. There you go. You'll have them at Croke Park in October. That'll be a delightful 90 minutes, I'm sure.
Well, I'd say it'll be a delightful sort of 87 minutes until Italy score their late winner.
And, right.
We get consigned to playoff, possibly against Northern Ireland. That'll be very interesting.
Wouldn't that be interesting? Now, equally interesting nature is what's happening in the rest of Europe. Hey, Portugal, what's going on there? We'll be dealing with all of that in just a second.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with sportingbet.com.
Right, rest of Europe. Portugal, as you may have seen, listeners, are in even more trouble than before. They've dropped to fourth place in their qualifying group. Sweden beat Hungary, while Portugal went to Denmark and drew 1-1. Very real chance Cristiano Ronaldo may miss out on South Africa.
Well, yeah, they were a bit unlucky in this game.
What?
Well, I think most of the play, and they just
couldn't really score.
And then also, Nicholas Bentner scored for Denmark.
Yeah, well, he scored lots of goals for Denmark.
That's true.
Yeah, and it was a good goal. They're in Hungary on Wednesday, the Portuguese, and they must win, naturally. We talked about all sorts of motives for their lack of success, the lack of forwards, the fact that Figo's retired, etc. Denby, posting in, points out that the real problem for them is the fact that they played in the third-fourth playoff in 2006. He illustrates the fact that whoever's been in the third-fourth playoff matches from the last few World Cups fails to attend the next World Cup. 1990, Italy versus England. England failed to qualify for 94. Sweden, Bulgaria in 94. Bulgaria failed to qualify for the next one. 98 was Croatia and Holland. Holland failed to get through to 2002. 2002 was Turkey and South Korea. Turkey failed to qualify for 2006. And 2006 was Portugal against Germany. And as Denby says, be honest, who is your money on? The Portuguese. How about the Germans, eh?
So the Germans played South Africa in a friendly in Leverkusen on Saturday. I had the pleasure of being there.
Yeah.
It was very, very interesting. And they changed the formation again in anticipation of the Russia game. So it was a slightly bizarre spectacle because they were playing a 4-2-3-1 against a very small, not especially a robust side. They only had one strike up front. So it was a bit weird, but it was really a test run for the Russia game in October.
No, the Russia game in October. Russia currently just 1 point behind you, but they're going to play Wales on Wednesday. How worried are you, Rafa?
You look
pretty worried. Are you worried?
I think it's a very, very difficult game for Germany. They haven't been playing well at all.
It's in Moscow, isn't it?
It's in Moscow. It's on artificial grass, of course. It's going to be tricky, and there is a lot of respect for Russia and for Hiddink amongst the Germans, and they were all talking about Russia even before South Africa, even before this game against Azerbaijan on Wednesday. Everybody's talking about Russia. And it will be the decisive game. And it is very feasible that they would lose there. I mean, Russia are one of the informed teams in Europe at the moment.
Right.
And they look very, very strong. But it was interesting because he had a very big impact from Mesut Özil on his debut in the starting 11. He's the under-21 captain for Germany who won it in the Euros. He plays for Bremen. He stepped in to fill the boots of Diego as the sort of pivotal playmaker. And he played really, really well. So well that people started making comparisons to Hesslers and Torn and all these, you know, young little number 10s that we once produced. Maybe he's the next one.
Well, crikey. Well, Russia, of course, had a 3-0 win over Liechtenstein, as Barry, you were about to point out, on the weekend. In Group 2, Switzerland now have a 3-point lead over Greece after beating them on the weekend, 2-0. In Group 5, European champion Spain, they're miles clear. In the battle for second place, crikey, it does look tight. Turkey managed to beat Estonia 4-2. They're going to be playing on Wednesday in Bosnia against Bosnia-Herzegovina. And that's a huge game, that one, if the Turks are going to have any chance of getting that second place and a potential playoff. In Group 7, France only managed a draw at home to Romania. They now need all 3 points when they visit Serbia, the group leaders, on Wednesday to secure at least a playoff berth. Crikey, Austria, who are their rivals for that, are in Romania themselves. There you go.
There's a four-point gap between Austria and France. So.
France have got Austria at home in the last game.
All right, then. All right, then. Abroad, two more teams gone through. We mentioned this at the start. Ghana, who beat Sudan 2-0 in Accra with goals from Suleyman Montari and Michael Essien. And, of course, Brazil, who beat Argentina 3-1 in Argentina. Absolutely must-win game, this, for the Argentines, who've now lost three of their last four. Joel Richards now joins us from Argentina. Joel, tell us all about it.
Well, the shockwaves are still going, reverberating after the match. I mean, there was so much hype about the game, so much talk about Maradona taking on Dunga and the different styles that they'd come out and play. And also, as you said, it was such an important game because Argentina went into the match fourth place to the last automatic qualifying position for the World Cup. They were let off the hook because Colombia beat Ecuador just before the match, because if Ecuador had got a win, they would have leapfrogged Argentina and put Argentina in fifth, which obviously is going to be a playoff position. But yeah, massive hype going into the game. But it really, after half an hour, it was so obvious what was going to happen. And to be honest, at the end of the game, the fact that the end of 3-1 was a bit of a let-off for Argentina, who were just completely outplayed. Tactically, they were nowhere near as good as Brazil. And it really was tremendously disappointing. And now they're in quite a dogfight, really, to make sure that they can still reach South Africa next year.
Well, indeed. And the Brazilians are delighted because they go through, and delighted because they've really stuck a spanner in the works for their arch rivals.
Well, it was a funny decision to go back to Rosario. They usually played in Buenos Aires at the River Plate Monumental, and Argentina really wanted to make life difficult for Brazil. They wanted to have an atmosphere where the fans were really close to the pitch, and you don't get that in a River Plate stadium. But that said, Brazil have got an excellent record in Rosario. They played there twice. They won one, and they drew the other game, which was in the 78 World Cup. And in the end, the home advantage just didn't work out, because these two early goals from Brazil just meant that the crowd were completely silenced, and all of a sudden there was no sort of other game plan from Argentina. Maradona had no other ideas of what to throw at them. Brazil were more than happy to put back four and the two holding midfielders behind the ball and make sure that Messi and certainly Carlos Tevez as well had no space to produce anything. And in the end, the main headline really was that there wasn't even, it's not about not having a plan B, there's no plan A.
Right, so what was the Argentine's press reaction? Is it all about Maradona must go?
It is, and it's also about Messi. It's about the fact that Messi's got too much responsibility. There's all this talk about how, you look at Messi, they watch him on TV over here, what he does for Barcelona when he plays alongside people like Xavi and Iniesta, and he's one of the best players in the world, without doubt. When he comes now to Argentina, he never reproduces that kind of form. So the questions are really about why that isn't happening, but most of the responsibility is being laid firmly at the door of Maradona for not finding that, for not having any sort of coherence in tactics, in his team selection, in the kind of football that he wants to play, and how he wants to get the best of his players.
So there are going to be big changes for the next game, which is away to Paraguay, is that right?
The next game's in Paraguay, which perhaps doesn't sound like the hardest of games. But Paraguay were leading the South American group for the early stage of the competition. They're still second. They won at the weekend, and that sort of recovered from a bit of a blip that they had in form over the last couple of games. And it's going to be very difficult. Also, the Paraguay coach is Argentine, Tata Martino. So he knows very well what to expect. He knows the players very well. And it's going to be a really difficult game. Also, it's a tough atmosphere to go to as well. One of Maradona's famous rivalries off the pitch is with José Luis Chilavert, the ex-goalkeeper as well. And he's making sure that there's lots of tension and lots of build-up for that game as well. So it's going to be a very difficult match for them. And because also, going into the game, Argentina could be not in the automatic qualification place, but they could be outside of the playoff position as well. So enormous amount of pressure for Argentina for that game. There are still only three games to go in the World Cup qualifiers, and if they don't get at least a point in Asunción on Wednesday, there's a real possibility that Argentina won't be making it to next year's World Cup.
Excellent. Well, Joel, thank you very much for that update on the disastrous situation of Maradona's Argentina. We'll see what happens after Wednesday's game in Paraguay. If, of course, they finish fifth, as Barry, you're well aware, that means they'll be taking on the fourth place team in the CONCACAF, a Central American group.
That's Costa Rica at the moment.
It is. They were leading, but then they got beaten by the resurgent Mexico on the weekend. Mexico thus moved up into third place. Costa Rica lie fourth. Honduras now leading. That's who Mexico play next. But there's only one point between that top four, Honduras, USA, Mexico and Costa Rica. So, my word, very, very exciting. Let us finish off then in a second or two with one of the really big stories of the last week in football, which happened, as these things are wont to do, a mere seconds after we'd finished our last podcast. And I refer, of course, to Chelsea's transfer ban. Are you ready, kids? All right. Well then, listeners, Kakukagate, as it surely should now be termed, Raphael Honigstein.
Yes.
So many questions. Is it right for them to be banned for two transfer windows? Will it stick? And will there be others out of the clubs?
Well, first of all, I think it's very difficult to judge this case without knowing any of the real circumstances, how he was signed.
It's actually easier. The less you know, I find the easier it is.
How much money did he get? What inducement was really there for him to breach this contract? And how binding is that pre-contract?
Mm.
Chelsea were clearly under the impression Weather? That that contract he had with Lance was non-binding, and they proceeded on that basis.
Do you think they bothered to find out, or they just went, oh?
No, I'm sure they've had some legal advice, and it conflicted with Lance's views. And of course, they did try to negotiate a deal, as that's what usually happens, and they couldn't agree, and then Lance took it to FIFA. So on the face of it, you'd say, right, this is a clear case, a breach of contract. I think it's Article 17 says if this happens, then the club is not allowed to register any new players in a two consecutive transfer window. So on the face of it, it looks a very clear-cut case. I think the interesting thing for me there is that a similar thing happened in Switzerland with Sion. They signed a player from Al Ahly. And what they did, of course, was they appealed. And they managed to put the appeal just at the time of the summer transfer window opening, and that allowed them to sign new players.
So Chelsea delayed their appeal.
Well, yes, but FIFA, I think, and that's why Chelsea are surprised, because they didn't expect this ruling for quite a while. Mm. But FIFA obviously saw this possibility and made sure to get this judgment out earlier than anybody anticipated, which then forces Chelsea to make an earlier appeal and already
so the verdict will be through before January.
Well, yeah, CAS, the Court of Arbitration of Sport in Lausanne, has already said that they will have that appeal verdict in before the end of December. So Chelsea can't even play, wind down the clock, as it were, in this case.
Well, being done for breach of contract, which is exactly what they're doing Mutu for, is karmatically quite interesting, of course. A lot of people are thinking that it's going to be reduced to just one transfer window, as happened with Roma, over their signing of Philip Mexes from Auxerre. But I guess one of the questions about all that is whether this is going to remain an isolated case, or whether there's going to be other evidence brought in by other clubs, because we're already hearing other clubs from France particularly saying, oh yeah, Chelsea did this and Chelsea did that, and Man United did the other.
It's all quite sinister. It's like that Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where all the children are getting stolen from the village and
they
put to work in the mines. And now Indy and Short Round, in the guise of Michel Platini and whatever, are going in and
Sepp Blatter,
worrying, trying to kill the high priest, who's Frank Arneson, who's ripping the heart out of sacrifices and holding it aloft.
He does pay handsomely though for that heart.
Well, Chelsea are lucky; they have such loyal and devoted players who love the club so much on their books at the moment. So there emphatically won't be a queue of senior players who were there already outside Roman Abramovich's door looking for new and improved juicy contracts.
Well, it's fascinating to think what effect it's going to have on Chelsea, this, if they don't manage to...
Well, some people say it could even be a beneficial effect.
Well, it's going to... You might find it, rather than players leaving, it might unite the squad.
Yeah.
And also this incredibly expensively
assembled... They might fire Frank Arneson as well, which could only
be also Peter.
Thing.
I mean, Peter Kenyon, isn't he essentially in charge of major transfer deals? Doesn't this effectively make him redundant? I mean, if they ever wanted an excuse to fire him, this is it. Your position is... no longer.
Well, the word on the street is that he was very much cautioning Arnesen against this, in Arnesen.
I wonder who put that word out.
But what's he going to do for the next two transfer windows as well? And he had a lot of time on his hand.
But hasn't Arnesen just been promoted anyway?
Yes. Right. Yes. For his stellar work.
5 years in charge of the Chelsea Academy. And who was the last Chelsea Academy player to make the first team? Barry knows.
Was it John Terry?
It was John Terry.
Robert Hoot.
Are we not counting Mancian as well?
Oh, okay. That Robert wasn't Hoot. John Terry.
But also, can I point out, was it
first
Chelsea
team regular, says producer Ben, who came up with this stat.
No, Robert Hoot.
Spoon fed it to us all earlier
on. That young lad I saw scoring the goal for Plymouth against
Scott Sinclair.
The wonder goal.
Yeah.
I presume he came through the.
Yeah, but he's not a first team regular at Chelsea.
The thing is.
But he has played for them.
You're talking about the consequences of this. The thing is that usually what happens in these cases is both sides threaten each other to go to FIFA or to do this and that, and of course they find a financial
settlement.
Well, we've gone past
because they've gone to FIFA and they've got...
But my point is that a lot of clubs now will say, no, we're not giving you this player.
Yeah.
Here's what's going to happen to you. You really face the threat of not being able to register any players. So the dynamic of negotiations between a wealthy club and a smaller club are going
to
change.
Well, it's interesting you say that. And I think that even Chelsea fans may well, to some extent, welcome this decision because it is plainly wrong. Taking players from the age of 11-year-old.
What makes you think they will welcome this decision?
Well, I think it's to some extent they will agree. If Chelsea were to, say, win their appeal, it would make it even easier for big, rich clubs to take young players away from the club where they've been trained, from their home environment, and take them abroad with no guarantee that they're actually going to have any kind of success at the end of it.
Are you even taking the idea that you should be able to go and play whoever you want to?
I think that most sensible folk in football, and I'm not sure how big that is.
Very small catchment area, sensible folk in football.
No, we'd say that player transfers before the age of, what should we say, 18? Just wrong.
I would imagine most Chelsea fans will just whinge and go, but Manchester United do it, but Arsenal do it.
And can we also make a point? There are still people out here, and bizarrely, that fellow on Goals on Sunday on Sky, what is his name?
Chris Kamara?
That's the one, the excitable fellow. He seemed to be still labouring under the notion that all that happened here was a simple case of tapping up, and why should it be any different? And Chelsea were offering this lad an opportunity. The fact is, this is different. They did, or according to FIFA's lawyers, there was a contract which Chelsea encouraged its player to walk out on. Il Chino posting and says, I have a question regarding this tapping up business in Chelsea. It's not a tapping up business, but anyway. Unless I'm mistaken, they were handed a suspended 3-point deduction in 2005 by the Premier League for tapping up Ashley Cole. Now that they've been found guilty of doing exactly the same thing again, will this deduction be enforced? And if not, why not?
It's a completely different thing. First of all, you're talking about the Premier League or the FA and FIFA. No, it's completely different because tapping up is something that never gets enforced because it's in no one's interest to do it because, you know, you talk to a player, if you want him, you sign him, you pay the other club a lot of money, everybody's happy. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. It only happened in this case because they were caught out sitting in a hotel room and there was evidence.
They actually called the thing.
Yes, yeah. And there was public pressure on the authorities to act. In 9,999 cases of transfers, the very same thing happens.
Out of how many?
10,000. All right, same thing happens, but of course no one does anything. Every single transfer is a tapping up transfer because you never make an offer before you talk to the player first, which is illegal, but it happens all the time. It's no one's interest to enforce this.
Right.
This is a different case because here you had a contract and instead of coming to an agreement, which could be tapping up, but instead of coming to an agreement, they just said, no, you come with us back to England, and Lance, you can go and F yourself.
Raphael, do you think there are a lot of other clubs who are going to be caught up now that this case has gone through? Other, say, French clubs or Spanish are going to come and say, listen, we've had the same thing happen to us.
Well, it all comes down to loopholes and to grey areas because what United and Arsenal have very clearly been doing is exploiting gaps in labour law abroad. Maqueda, Fabregas, they came because they couldn't sign legally binding contracts at their clubs at the time. Mm. So British clubs came in and said, here you go, you become an official apprentice at 16, no problem under English law, British law, you come with us. This was a different case. So it comes down to whether how many clubs like Chelsea took such an aggressive view on that pre-contract situation and just thought or had the advice, pre-contracts are not binding, nothing's going to happen, just take the guy with him.
Well, Chelsea are actually not as aggressive by the looks of the numbers as their big four rivals. They have five foreign youngsters in their academy. Liverpool have nine, Arsenal eight, as do Manchester United, who bought a house, it is alleged, for the parents of 16-year-old Paul Pogba. That's what the president of Le Havre AC says.
No, I mean, Fabregas' parents, I think, got a job, you know, at
Akita's
Arsenal.
Got a job.
It's all part of the deal.
Hmm.
But didn't Chelsea reunite that young French boy's parents? So it's a heartwarming story.
Tell us.
Well, they were estranged.
Yes.
And the boy wasn't allowed to come to England I think it's FIFA regulation, unless his parents go with him up to a certain age. So despite the fact that his parents were no longer together, Chelsea somehow persuaded them to go and live together in the same house again.
Counseling? In Wimbledon. What do you think? Candlelit dinners?
Must have been, probably. Right.
Crikey.
I would say that this is exactly... This sort of thing has always happened in English football. It's usually happened on a regional basis. Players have been offered suits of clothes and their parents have been offered jobs. It's very common in English football, right from the 1920s onwards. Mm. And they've just taken it onto the big stage. And it now seems...
But it's not about offering sweeteners. It's about taking somebody... of having disregard for local law and saying... well, that's what the FIFA judgment is. It's saying there was a contract here. Chelsea said that it didn't count and therefore they are now going
to
pay.
The reason why that seems acceptable in English football and to the people who are involved in running it is because this is the way English clubs have always worked.
Hmm.
No, because you never unilaterally just breach a contract. You would have said, you come to us, and then the club would have said, we want $500,000. They would have said, no, we'll give you 200. And they would have had a deal.
What's the labour law in Germany?
I mean, the Italians are the Spanish. There are plenty of German French, clubs who've had similar situations where clubs have come and taken their players. But they've always it's always been done with an agreement, as far as I know. There's never been a FIFA complaint.
Well, no, with the Italians, as you mentioned, is that they have this problem where they can't sign professional contracts until they're 18. So you've had a flood of players from Gattuso onwards, basically exiting, and Makeda, the later high-profile example. Yeah,
anyone tried to tap up your boy?
No.
He's about that age now.
He's about that age, 8 years old. Yeah. No. Barney, at the end of the day, though, these players actually accept the transfer. It's not like they are hit on the head with a cosh and awake on the high seas or anything. So is it actually a bad thing that English clubs offer these youngsters the opportunity?
Well, I just think in terms of their own development, it's probably hard to argue that it's better for this kid to be playing in the Chelsea reserves, turning out in testimonial matches and doing whatever they do with their younger players when he could be playing for Lens, presumably. It's going to be better for his development. They're taking a punt on 20 or 30 kids who they'll go and harvest from around the world who won't be playing for Chelsea.
I mean, that's the thing. These kids, say, at 10 or 11, there's no guarantee they're going to make it as professional footballers. So if you're that kid's parents, you obviously want to send them out to start earning as quickly as possible.
Reminds
just
the
on the off chance that he won't be earning anymore once he turns 15 or 16.
The club who lost Messi to Barcelona could have made the same case.
Yeah.
Oh, there's all these guys at Barcelona, none of them make it. But obviously, they have such a great academy.
One of them is going to be a Messi or a Fabregas, but that's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, but that's the problem. If you want to aspire to be a top professional footballer, you have at some stage have to take that risk and you can't continue playing for Lens all your life. If at 16...
How old is he?
He was 16.
Yeah, but 16's time to be...
Come on, I mean, four years playing for Lens.
He was 15, actually, at the time.
Are you really saying that the guys who signed for Arsenal, for example, would be better off at their local clubs rather than coming through at a very young age?
Arsenal have a good record of looking after those players, don't they? But Chelsea don't, particularly. I mean... I think this kid, if you think he's going to be better off spending 4 years playing for Chelsea reserves and youth team than possibly getting in the first team at his club and learning that way. I mean, it's better for Chelsea if they've got him under their control at the age of 16, but whether it's good for him.
It's very hypothetical, and I think that's why there shouldn't be a blank ban on the under-18s, because you'd have a lot of cases where it's not Lens or a really good French club who have experience. It might be just really some local club who don't have the facilities, who don't have the manpower, who don't have the know-how to properly train a youngster, and why shouldn't he move to a big team where he can get much better footballing education?
Yeah, some people suggest that an international...
Whether that's going to be better if this is what happens now, that everybody goes to these big centralised big clubs where that's the way you learn, that's the way your years as a young player are spent, whether it's better for those players.
It would also be better for the spread of talent across the league, potentially. There is the case
if he had a...
No, just
sorry,
to say... No, No, yeah. I'm just saying that the 18-year-old ban thing, some people argue it should only apply to international transfers.
Then the problem is then is that John Ubu-Mikel will have to sit in Nigeria until he's 18 before he can play in Europe. Is that good for his development? No, clearly not.
It's an interesting point, Rafael.
Players do emerge from Nigeria without going to Norway first. It is possible.
Won't somebody please think of the children? Has anyone spoken to them? They might be sort of Billy Elliot types. They might even want to be footballers. They might want to dance.
Perhaps so. Won't somebody think of the listeners, says producer Ben. And producer Ben, who has to edit all this into a listenable podcast-style entertainment. So let's leave it at that, eh? Plenty of thought-provoking material, as ever. And as such, many, many thanks to Raphael Honigstein for appearing with us today. Barry Glendinning, excellent work as ever. Barney Rone, valuable contribution. And you, producer Ben. We'll be back on Thursday with yet more international football talk after the qualifiers on midweek. And also, let me just remind you once again, on the 20th, Sunday the 20th of September, we're live from 6 o'clock, streaming on The Guardian's website. So do join us for that. Hey, for now though, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with SportingBet.com.